Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Childhood is supposed to be all about learning, making mistakes, trying new things, adopting some, rejecting others. But this vital stage of messing up and moving on can be altered when so many aspects of kids' lives are captured online in a culture that our guest today, author Leah Plunkett, calls Sharenthood, the title of her new book. In it, Plunkett urges adults to understand the consequences before they click and share and post. Despite your best privacy settings, it might not just be family and friends seeing those adorable photos. And Plunkett says Sharenthood encompasses far more than pictures, covering all kinds of data that provide enticing fodder for companies eager to monetize the information and create a digital footprint for our kids that will follow them for a long time. Today in The Exchange, what Sharenthood is and why its risks are underappreciated. Let's hear from you, our email exchange at nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. And Leah Plunkett, welcome to The Exchange. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Such a pleasure to be here.
Leah is also a professor at the UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law, faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. Leah, what is Sharenthood and what isn't it?
Sharenthood is the practice that parents, teachers, and other trusted adults have in this day and age of using digital technologies, so social media, but as you said, Laura, so much more than that, to publish, transmit, store, or engage in other activities with children's private digital data. So that's a very law professor answer, but that's intentional because Sharenthood encompasses all of those things that we do intentionally or inadvertently in our daily lives, where we are picking up sensitive information about our children through an app, social media, a smart refrigerator, an ed tech program, educational technology program. So Sharenthood is very, very broad. What Sharenthood isn't would be those activities that we engage in with our children's information that don't have a digital aspect to them. So I don't think of Sharenthood as being making a holiday card and sending it out. That's good old-fashioned, you know, snail mail. Now, of course, Laura, if you are using an online site for your photos, so Shutterfly or...
Which most people, that's
most
how they
of
make
us
those.
Do, of course. Yeah. I'm a big fan of Tiny Prints. So you start to see then the crossover of even seemingly brick and mortar activities into what I would call Sharenthood.
So, is Sharenthood, Leah, giving the school your kids information? Is it giving the doctor information about your kid? Is it my kids went to summer camp, so all the forms are filled out online? Not just stuff like, you know, age and so forth, but likes and dislikes. Is that Sharenthood? Because you kind of have to do that. You can't send in these forms on paper anymore.
Yes, 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 and yes. That is all Sharenthood. You are digitally transmitting data to a third party about your child. You're absolutely right that there are certain instances in which it's really impractical or even impossible to do it any other way. But unlike other folks who've talked about this term sharenting, a lot of them have confined it to just being on social media. And you'll even see the New York Times Privacy Project has run several stories recently about sharenting. And they are really limiting it to social media transmission by parents. I think that's way too narrow. And it fails to appreciate the breadth and the depth of the ways in which that we are giving away our children's personal information via digital channels. And there are many reasons, you've just given several of them, Laura, where we either need to or essentially need to, but it's still sharenthood.
So what do you do about that aspect of it? We're definitely going to talk about social media for sure, Leah. But again, in the case of the summer camp, in case of the school, in the case of the doctor, I don't have a choice. I have to fill that out electronically. There is no option to say, here's your paper, mail it in with a stamp.
I'm so glad you started with summer camp, because summer camp is one where, yes, we do either have to or want to enroll our kids in summer camp if we work or need them taken care of. But summer camps have really started pushing the envelope recently on just how much they want. When I signed my son up for a summer camp, not here in the state, but out of state nearby, this summer, I did fill out the forms online. I will confess, did I take the time to read the privacy policies in terms of use? No, I did not, because I was filling them out probably around midnight on going through my to-do list. But here's something I did do. There was a little button that said, click here to use the facial recognition software program that the camp has. So you could upload a picture of your child, click accept on this one pop-up window on the camp's registration website, and they would use facial recognition software to find your child in camp photos and tag him or her or them for you, and you would get a little alert at the end of the day, here are the pictures of your child using facial recognition software.
Okay, so that's kind of fun. Here's Jimmy, you know, making a bead necklace. I don't know.
I don't think it's fun. I think it's creepy. I really do appreciate wanting to know what your child's up to. I love getting pictures of my kids by text message. I love seeing pictures of my kids that other people post tastefully and respectfully, and I don't have any concerns about anyone in my own life. But I don't want a camp using surveillance technology that's also now being used by law enforcement and other government officials to find and track my child, because I don't know what they're going to do with it. I don't know what's going to happen to it downstream. Even if it hadn't been midnight and I wanted to put on my lawyer hat and try to parse those terms of use and privacy policies, good luck to me, because I'm guessing. I didn't even look at this particular one. I just opted out. But I am guessing there was a language in there that reserved the right to change the terms and conditions at any time, that reserved the right to share the information with other third-party providers or folks who might, you know, buy that product provider later on. So it's just not even worth it. So I do think your question about camps and doctor's offices and schools, we can pick and choose within those digital platforms to some extent. And I certainly would always encourage parents, if they are feeling at all uncomfortable, stop and ask questions and ask for paper forms. There may be very good reasons some folks with disabilities or English as a second language should still have access to good old-fashioned paper and pen. I'm not saying that's always safer. A really secure digital system might be safer than an unlocked file cabinet in somebody's office gathering dust. But I do think that parents should feel empowered to at least ask, and certainly to decline those things I might think of as kind of sharenting add-ons.
Yeah, the secondary stuff that you mentioned.
Right.
Wow. All right. Lots to talk about. I want to remind our listeners that they can join us. Our number here in the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. So, Leah, since you were just talking about your own experience sharenting, what else do you do and not do in terms of sharing your own family life that some listeners might think, oh, I never thought about that before?
I don't like smart assistants in the home, so Alexa and all of those. I recognize that they can be very, very convenient, and I'm certainly perfectly happy to have my child or, you know, myself in a home that has one. But just in terms of my own family, I am deeply suspicious of the ways in which those smart assistants and also other smart technologies, so Nest Cam, Amazon has that new sort of smart doorbell that will sort of scan your front porch. You can have smart refrigerators, smart thermostats. My home doesn't need to be that smart. It just doesn't. Those, to me, feel like things that, while there's a little bit of convenience to them, we really don't have a good handle right now on exactly how much data they're picking up, what is being done with it now, and in, for me, even more alarming, where that data might travel downstream. So that's a really big one for me, is the so-called smart home. I am deeply suspicious.
What else, Thea, in terms of information you might share with your kids' schools or your own social media habits? Do you put pictures of your kids on Facebook, for example?
Occasionally.
You do? Okay.
I do occasionally. I don't do it a lot, and I've done it less and less as time has gone on. This book is really the product of the convergence of the personal and the professional, so many things are for working parents. I began my time as a researcher at the Berkman Klein Center at around the same time I started parenting. And as I got further into my research on digital privacy and youth life, holy moly, that stuff started to freak me out. So I will occasionally share things and on social media about my children. I do not post pictures of them where they're not fully clothed. Even when they were born, I hadn't started researching digital, but I was practicing consumer rights law. And I remember asking my husband and family members, all of whom very graciously agreed, I said, please don't give the full name. Please don't give the exact sort of day and time of birth. Don't give height and weight, because identity theft for kids can be a really big issue, because kids have an unvarnished credit history, or they should. And so if you're putting really intimate details about the origins of someone's identity, so the time, place of their birth, the manner of their birth, it's a lot easier for identity thieves to get that information and create a fake account under your child's name. So I have always been particularly uptight or vigilant, depending on how you want to term it, about identifying details and photos that might be in any stage of undress.
So you're going to have to connect the dots for us on the identity theft. And I did read that the prediction is a large percentage of identity theft in the future will be based on some of the sharenting that we are doing today. But just connect the dots for us, Leah, please, between identity theft, having your identity stolen, people digging into your bank account or whatever, a serious problem right now. What's the connection between that and somebody putting on Instagram, here's my adorable toddler at the beach?
So here's my adorable toddler at the beach is probably a little more removed than here is the exact time, location, and full name of my toddler when he, she, or they were born. I would be less concerned about the toddler at the beach and more concerned about birthdays and age and full name. Because if you think about how one goes about opening an application for credit, you're being asked for details of your identity. You're being asked for, of course, social security numbers, which are vulnerable, as we've seen from Anthem and all, you know, the other institutions that legitimately have them and then have them get hacked. But if you think about, we'll just go back to Anthem. You think about a data breach where social security numbers are taken. My family was involved in the Anthem breach. I think a lot of us here in the state were. And so they get the social and they get your child's full name. They get the place of birth, they get potentially a current address, it becomes very easy for them to connect the dots and request credit cards, mortgages, all sorts of things, constructing an identity for your child. And you as the parent have sharented that social security number with the healthcare provider, probably digitally when you applied. I am certainly not saying to anyone, don't get health insurance because they use digital tools. Of course, if you are fortunate enough to have health insurance, get it by any means necessary. But I am saying that if you think about the ways that you identified and the others in which it's really essentially impossible to live in this day and age and not be somewhat digital, as parents, teachers, grandparents, coaches, and other caregivers, why are we giving away additional intimate data points that could be layered on top of the information that we already have to give institutions for legitimate reasons, but that information in this day and age is not secure?
That's interesting. So hence the subtitle of your book, Leah, Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online. You're not saying don't, but you're saying think.
Correct. And I'm really encouraging folks to think about trying, first of all, to have conversations like the ones you and I are having now. I very intentionally did not write a here's what to do manual, because I don't think I know what each and every one of us should be doing. I'm still learning about what my family and I should do. But I do recommend in the book, Laura, a thought compass of principles that all of us can be thinking about when we make these sharenting decisions. And I talk in the book about play, forget, connect, and respect as being an overarching thought compass of sorts that we can all apply to our own lives.
It's interesting that you put play first. So I want to ask you about that in a second, Leah. Again, you can join us with your questions and comments on this topic called Sharenthood. That's the title of a new book by our guest author, UNH Law Professor Leah Plunkett, where, as she just said, she urges parents and other trusted adults to think before they talk about their kids online. How much do you share photos and information online? What do you feel is required? What might be optional? Again, we'd love your thoughts. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter, and you can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Talk a little bit more, Leah, about the creation of a digital story or footprint about a kid before he or she has any chance to weigh in on it. You put on your law professor hat in this book and you say the law treats kids as kids. They're minors. They don't have certain rights. But what's that feeling about, that something, a profile has been created when you, the person who is being profiled, really has had no say?
It can feel like a violation of autonomy and agency when kids get old enough to realize it. So you're absolutely right. Under our legal system here in this country, it's not up to a child to consent or not consent to a parent, teacher, or other adult posting anything, especially really focusing on parents. Parents get to make those decisions unless they're up against the outer boundaries of what other laws prohibit, like criminal law would prevent child pornography, thank goodness. But I think that putting the law aside and just thinking about our own lived experiences, there can be a sense of creepiness or of embarrassment or of some sort of violation when kids then realize it. One thing that I talk about is, in order to try to put yourself in your child's shoes, ask yourself, if my parents had shared about my bedwetting at night when I was 3 years old, right? If back in the pre-digital era, if my parents had taken out a billboard or an ad in the local newspaper or gone up to the pulpit at church and said, little Johnny is still wetting the bed and I'm so frustrated. Oh my G, OMG, hashtag parent fail. Well, first of all, even a three-year-old would probably be upset about that. Second, if you turned 13 and hadn't realized there'd been that billboard up and then you saw a picture of it, you would freak out, and you should. It's weird.
Do parents post about problems like that?
Parents do post about problems, and I get why. I have two wonderful children. I adore them. And then there are also times when they can be challenging or frustrating or you feel inadequate as a parent. I certainly I'm in close touch with my friends and family and the, you know, sort of the people I trust about things that I want help dealing with. But I think that we get seduced, and the tech companies are trying to seduce us into thinking, well, just because the phone fits in my hand and it's in my home and I'm using the phone to just, you know, talk about something in my home while I'm in my home, that it's somehow an intimate space. And there's no privacy setting that is going to keep a revelation about toilet training or tantrums from leaving the bounds of your home environment or the app that you shared it in.
We'll talk a lot more after a short break, and we'll start taking your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us. We'd love to hear from you. Your thoughts, comments, concerns about this concept that Leah Plunkett calls sharenthood. More in a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
So
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, Sharonthood. That's the title of a new book by author and UNH law professor Leah Plunkett. In it, she urges parents to think before they share, post, or click with their kids' images and information online. She outlines the risks involved that could follow children well into adulthood. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. What are your thoughts on this? Tweet us, comment on Facebook. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. And Leah, let's go to our listeners. Dan is calling from Nashua. Hi, Dan. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. Wanted to, first of all, just express my appreciation for Leah's work. I think this is so, so important for families and for society. And then just share a quick realization. My wife and I have three young kids now. And before our twins were born, my wife was pretty clear that we were going to share nothing about them online, never show their faces or talk about any personal details. And I was a little crestfallen, admittedly, because I'm pretty active on social media, for better or for worse, involved in causes and things. And I just knew that, you know, there's so much affirmation that comes when one announces birth and shows those cute pictures. And I kind of realized it was really more about me than about them. And my wife's point, and she's held the line for years now, is that it's a choice they ought to be able to make for themselves. That, you know, when you're putting them out there in a public domain, and even to a wide friends network, we all know that they're friends and then real friends, that it's not a decision we should make for our kids. So I just wanted to share that realization. Didn't come easily for me, but something that we've stood by and has felt really right as time's gone by.
So what do you do now, Dan, if I might ask?
We continue that. They're not so old as to be able to decide for themselves yet if they want to put themselves out there. But as long as, until they're teenagers, I think we'll keep them, keep their identities totally private online. And then they'll get to decide. And we also hope to keep them away from screens till then, as long as we can.
Oh, well, Dan,
Good.
It's really good to hear from you. And lots of thoughts from that call, Leah. First of all, it's so interesting to hear him talk about the conflict between him and his wife.
And I love the way that they have talked about it and come up with a shared family operating principle, really around respect and the value that they're putting on creating a sense of self for their children and honoring that fledgling sense of self, recognizing that very young children are not in a position to weigh in on the decision. So the more you can protect them from making decisions for them that aren't ultimately necessary. So Dan is talking here about social media. He's not saying that, you know, as per our earlier conversation, Laura, that they're not sharing information with a school or a healthcare provider. But he's saying this is a space that is appealing to me as a parent. And I totally get why as well. You know, there's that endorphin hit of feeling liked, both in terms of the actual thumbs up and also in terms of the internal feeling. But he's saying that they have made a family commitment to have that take a back seat to respecting a private space for their kids to develop their own sense of self and identity, such that by the time their kids are a little bit older, they will have a sense of self and a sense of value so that they can make good decisions for themselves down the road.
It's tricky. I thought about this. Thank you, Dan. I thought about this recently. I was at a little beach by the Merrimack River with one of my boys and a bunch of his friends. And there was a couple there with this adorable toddler. And the dad was playing with her and the mom was filming it, you know, on her phone. And you see this a lot. And maybe they were going to share that video with grandma who lives across the country. Or maybe they were going to share it with a sister who has a daughter of a similar age and compare notes. And so what's wrong with that, Leah?
I think that the kind of internal family sharing you're talking about, where it is an email, a text message, something that stays really as private as you can be in a digital forum. And now I will, of course, recognize that email gets hacked. Phones are not always secure. There is nothing to stop the person who receives it from uploading it. But assuming sending it to sister, grandma, I think that's lovely. I do that all the time. You know, I will share, if I may. My folks live halfway across the country, and I send them a lot of photos and videos. But I do think that there is a difference in terms of exposure between doing everything you can within the realm of existing digital technology to only reach your intended audience, and putting it out there so widely that not only is it possible to have the content itself reshared, but you are making it more vulnerable to the third-party platform that you're using to extract data from it, to analyze the data, to aggregate the data, to reshare the data, and have it wind up with data brokers such that it can be used for unknown entities down the road to make major decisions about your kids' futures.
So third-party platforms, mm-hmm. Facebook, sure. Instagram, which Instagram is owned by Facebook, so kind of the same thing, but third-party platforms do, when you sign up, you know, you check all the boxes about privacy and so forth, but you're saying that's not trustable. They could sell that data. Someone else could hack it. Someone else could peek into it. Tagging can happen on those platforms, so you don't trust those privacy settings, it sounds like.
I don't trust them at all.
And at all?
I really don't, and I still use them. I'm on Facebook. I'm on LinkedIn and all of that. But I think we've seen enough revelations, even within this month alone, and it's only, you know, still not even the middle of September, that these big tech giants really don't hold themselves accountable. And so they can change their privacy policies in terms of use. They can have activity going on that they claim to not even be fully aware of. And I use them, but I use them without any faith that what they're telling me now is either transparent, complete, or accurate, or that it will be binding on them going forward.
Well, and you mentioned that when we talked about the camps, that some privacy policies, quote, reserve the right to change at any time. I mean, what good is that? You know, if you can change it at any time, what good is it?
It's of almost no use, especially given that in order to try to read that privacy policy or those terms of use, that can take hours. And if you're using a smart device, so a Fitbit or a Garmin or another internet-able device that you wear on your body or carry on your body, good luck finding those privacy policies in terms of use. Everyone who's wearing a Fitbit, take it out and look at it. They're not printing a nutrition-style label on that Fitbit. So to find those privacy policies in terms of use, you're going to have to go to the hard copy instructions that come with it. You're going to have to go to the app or the software program that's connected to it and dig through until you can find it. And by that point, you know, just to find language that is going to likely reserve the right to change at any time and share with affiliates and, you know, and other folks needed, or so the terms will say, to support the product, it really is meaningless, I think.
Here's an email that came in from Lisa, who says, I fully support this idea. I always tell my daughter that it's her body, her choice, and I believe that her privacy is a part of that. Good for you, Leah. I wish you the best. Lisa, thank you very much for that note. What does the law say, Leah, about minors and their privacy? You've written that the law maybe is a little outdated when it comes to this.
The law is very outdated at this point. So unless you are talking about things that are prohibited by what the law professor in me calls laws of general applicability, right? So meaning not a specific privacy law, but our criminal law. So it would violate a minor's privacy for a parent or other caregiver to subject that minor to abuse and neglect and put that online. And this is not just a law professor hypothetical. We have seen that happen. I talk in the book about a YouTube channel called Daddy05, where viewers alerted the local child protective authorities to what was happening in that home, and the parents actually were taken to court over it. But the basis of the legal action and the rights that the minor had were not fundamentally about privacy. They were about being free from abuse and neglect. So with respect to parents, in almost all situations, parents are the ones who get to decide whether, when, why, and how to share private information about children. And even institutions like schools that have state and federal privacy laws that apply directly to them, the underlying framework for that law, Laura, is still parental consent. So FERPA, which is the big student privacy law, the federal one, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, which went into effect in 1974, does give schools the ability to share private information about students with third parties if certain criteria are met. But the underlying basis of that law is that schools are supposed to get parental consent before they share what we call PII, personally identifiable information from education records. They can only share without parental consent if certain specific criteria are fulfilled. So I bring that up to say that even the most overarching federal law we have on youth privacy, because the other big federal law on youth privacy, COPPA, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, is for kids under 13. Even FERPA is going back to this idea of parental consent. So our laws really do not give minors the ability to have a voice in, and certainly not to control, their own digital privacy, despite the fact that oftentimes kids and teens can be more sophisticated at least about the technology aspect of things, and sometimes even about the privacy part of things, than their parents are.
Well, and we've been talking a lot about kids. We should talk about teenagers in a moment, Leah. Again, I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So since you alluded to it, Leah, let's talk about it. The Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, CHOPPA in shorthand. This was what got Google and YouTube into trouble just recently, right, Leah? Where, because YouTube is owned by Google, and Google and YouTube were accused of sharing kids' data, kind of tracking and watching them while they were watching, you know, little cartoon videos. So what happened there, Leah? Just remind us, and then how that folds into this concept of sharenthood.
Sure. So Google's YouTube has settled allegations that it broke federal law by violating the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. They have to pay about $170 million. And as you said, Laura, the allegations are that they were tracking viewers of their children's channels using cookies, so that little device that collects information as you go, without parental consent, and then using the information gleaned from those cookies to direct millions of dollars in advertisements to youth viewers. One of the things that I find so interesting about this settlement is that it highlights the space that sharenting behaviors still have. So COPPA is about when a website is collecting personal information from children under 13. And there's some criteria that attach to that website. It has to be a commercial provider, so it doesn't apply to nonprofits. It has to be focused on trying to reach kids under 13 or have actual knowledge that kids under 13 use it. So even though it is considered best practice for an operator to apply the same kinds of standards to information it collects about children 13 and over, or information it collects about children from their parents, COPPA does nothing, absolutely nothing, to limit the ability of all of us to share it. In fact, the essence of the violation here that is causing, I think I read one news report that said that $170 million figure is roughly what it takes to run either the FTC or the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau for a year. So, you know, you do the math, it's convenient. But they're upset that YouTube didn't get verifiable parental consent. So it's all coming back to the parent. If they had gotten parental consent, then the kids could have used the YouTube channel geared toward kids without a problem.
So they didn't get parental consent. That's the problem.
Correct.
They got in trouble. A lot of people say not enough trouble, but they got in trouble. But you're saying, Leah, this is kind of related to Sharonhood in that parents, adults, do this all the time.
Exactly.
Maybe unknowingly.
Exactly. So that there are really two big categories of ways that YouTube and other digital providers get information about children. They can get that information directly from the child, which is what COPPA is concerned about and is what YouTube was accused of doing wrong in this case. Or they can get that information about the child from someone else, usually an adult. One of the things I do find interesting about this settlement is that YouTube said in a statement, I think it was last week, that, and I'm reading now from a Reuters article, that in 4 months it would begin treating all data collected from people watching children's content as if it came from a child. So in other words, they are saying we are actually going to go beyond what we're required to do under COPPA and say, if you are a viewer of content that is aimed at children, we are going to treat you as if you are a child, even if, in fact, you are 13 or over. So that's a little bit of a ray of hope to me that we're going to start seeing companies taking a broader approach than the law requires in terms of protecting information that they might get from a minor of any age or about a minor of any age.
A couple emails I'd like to share with you, Leah. Otto writes, wondering how your guest feels about posting things to, quote, stories where the photos, quote, disappear after 24 hours. This is a really good question. And just for listeners who may not be as digitally savvy, remind people of the difference between posting something on Instagram, for example, and posting it to Instagram stories, because there is a difference, as Otto points out.
Absolutely. And Otto's right that the story feature allows you to have a picture and a post up for a certain period of time. I think it is 24 hours, and then it cycles off. I do think that in terms of not developing a digital dossier for your child, that is as easy for other people to follow. Stories are better. The content disappears. You can sort of think about it as almost, as I call it in the book, an auto-forget setting. I do actually. I'm no pun intended. But where I still would have pause about it is for two reasons. One is, of course, anyone who sees the story when it's up can screenshot it and keep the picture.
Sure.
I don't know why you would busy yourself doing that about other people's stories, but
well,
who knows?
But if you're a data broker who sees some opportunity to make money there.
Exactly.
You know, if the kid posts a story about really liking this kind of sneaker, then sure.
Exactly. And then you absolutely hit the nail on the head, Laura, for the other privacy concern is the ability for the platform itself and other third parties it works with to potentially extract data. And I'm not going to pick on Instagram in particular at all right now, but just say broadly speaking, there is both what other people will see and be able to preserve from that Instagram story, and there's what could happen behind the scenes with metadata or other information extracted from that that could, you're absolutely right, be aggregated by a data broker and used to profile your child even though the story disappears.
Yeah, and does it really disappear?
Never.
Yeah. All right. Well, Otto, thank you very much for that point. Joseph writes, what do you suggest to a teenager who is now realizing they are a victim of this type of parenting? Wow, Joseph, thank you.
Talk to your parents. Do your research first and go to your parents and talk to them about why these kinds of sharenting behaviors can have lasting negative impacts, because I would go, I have not done empirical research on this, but I will still go on the record as saying I am confident that most, if not essentially all parents, want what's best for their kids. But I would go to them, Joseph, and help model good digital citizenship. You may know more than they do.
All right. Thank you very much, Joseph, for the email. We will talk more after a short break, and we'll keep taking your comments and questions. So send them in, your thoughts, personal experiences with sharenting. Our email exchange at nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. what does it mean to be civil?
Are we supposed to talk with people with views completely different from our own?
Ask yourself those same questions that you want to ask other people.
Without attacking that person as immoral, you're much more likely to have a rich conversation.
I'm Laura Kanoy, host of The Exchange. Civility is about sharing different perspectives with the context you need and the respect we all deserve. When you become a sustaining member, your automatic monthly contributions support the civil conversations you hear on NHPR. Learn more at nhpr.org and click support. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup for all the state news you might have missed this week. That's Friday morning, live at 9. This hour, Sharenthood. That's the title of a new book we're looking at today, urging parents and other trusted adults who work with kids to think before we share information about children online. The author is Leah Plunkett, professor at the UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law, faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. And we've been hearing from you, your questions, comments, conflicts about this. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can tweet us or comment on Facebook. Leah, we've been talking a lot about specifics. It's been very eye-opening for me, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners, when you have to share, when you really don't, types of sharing that might be a little safer for your kids, giving them sort of agency over what kind of image we put up out there online. So very specific. But what about the sort of ethical or meta issue about this phase, childhood, which you should be allowed to mess up and move on, to learn from your mistakes?
I really am concerned that in our digital environment, where so much is tracked in real time, it's tracked and can be used to make decisions about children down the road, that we really are eroding a traditional notion of childhood as a protected space to play. And play means both fun, it means experimentation and iteration, but it also means the ability, as you were saying, Laura, to make mischief, to make mistakes, to learn from them and grow up better for having made them. And in a world where so much of what our children do is captured, whether it's in, you know, the venting social media post or maybe in much more subtle ways, like, let's say, a school that is using a digital technology platform to track disciplinary incidents. There are technologies out there where schools can assign social and emotional learning modules to kids whom they feel would benefit from some behavioral correction. That data is being tracked and analyzed, and it's in many different places right now, but it's not likely to stay there. And so I am very sad that I think in today's world, children don't have a protected space to play, to learn about who they are, and to grow up free from the mess-ups that they had when they were kids.
So setting aside the sort of behavioral tracking at schools or with law enforcement or even the medical information, Leah, because there is certainly some value to the medical system in your town knowing that your kid
Absolutely.
Has an allergy to
Absolutely.
Whatever. But how does parents who, you know, video a lot of the stuff that their kids do or post all the time the things that their kids are doing, you know, happy, pleasant stuff, it seems so nice. They want to share it with their friends. How does that harm the fundamental nature of this, what did you call it, this sacred space of childhood?
An iterative space, sure, sacred. I like sacred. I'm going to start using that. I think in a couple of ways. One is I think kids from a very young age do become aware of when they are being photographed and may start to subtly perform or not perform for a camera. And also, it does impact children's ability to develop a sense of self when people who may, you know, let's say they're putting on a little play at home or just being cute and silly and we all like to see it. And the next day they bump into someone who is, you know, a friend of a friend of a friend, and that person has seen the little video that's gone up. That person may ask them about it or form an idea about them based on it. And if that happens, you know, once in a while, who cares or who notices? But as it adds up, I do worry that the reputation that we're building for our kids, both in real time and down the road, will start to creep into their own sense of self and their own consciousness, and that it will impact how we see them and how they see themselves as being sort of always on display and always accountable for things.
That's interesting. So children have a right to develop their own sense of self-identity. And if you as a parent are constantly putting out pictures or videos or information or whatever, saying, you know, here's what Susie did, here's what Susie did, here's what Susie did, and that's what you highlight, Susie starts to understand that's what's important, that's what the world likes, I guess that's what I'm going to be.
Exactly. Susie understands that, and the people who are seeing it think that about Susie. And collectively, to go back, as you said, Laura, to the sort of big picture, we all start to subtly shift our understanding of childhood to be a little bit more about performance or display or this kind of narrative, as opposed to just, all right, kids, go play in the dirt. Call me if someone gets hurt. Otherwise, go play pretend. Go play with your friends. Go out into the woods and have a good time. And it doesn't matter what you do out there as long as everyone's safe. And it will be gone tomorrow, because that's part of the ephemeral nature of play, is make-believe. And when we're capturing it and sharing it and turning it into performance, as well as digital data points, we as a society have just lost the ability to appreciate that.
Here's an email from Scott who says, I've heard a lot about the new-ish European standards for consumer privacy, and I'm wondering if Leah could offer her thoughts on what they're doing better than the U.S. Scott, thank you very much.
That's a great question, Scott. So GDPR, which went into effect in May of 2018 over in Europe, does provide, in the EU, much more extensive privacy rights for data subjects than we have here. And there's a right to be forgotten, a right to erasure in the EU, that would allow children about whom, who have shared information about themselves under a certain age, to request down the road that it be erased or forgotten once they obtain what's considered an age of majority. So the EU is moving toward not a perfect ability for kids to get a clean slate heading into adulthood, but a better one. And we are starting to see some movement on the level of state law here in this country toward not a full GDPR, but a bit more of a right to erasure, right to be forgotten. California has a new Consumer Privacy Act that goes into effect next year that starts to have some movement in that direction.
That's interesting. We did a show on Monday, Leah, and I'm going to push back on that a little bit, although I'm sure a lot of people would appreciate our kids having that. We did a show on Monday on whether you can profile a mass shooter or not. And people talked about, you know, the importance of little bits of information, someone who seems angry, who seems depressed, who seems perhaps suicidal, and the importance of pulling together all those dots so that we can offer that person some help before they get dangerous. So I just, you know, we don't like the idea of our data being shared with law enforcement, but in some instances, this guest said, it could be helpful.
Absolutely. And I am a huge proponent of making sure that law enforcement and other government officials and other institutional decision makers have access to reasonable and legally regulated information. Where I start to get uncomfortable is this idea of, just because we can track it or surveil it or figure it out, we necessarily need to. I have seen law enforcement officials, to go back to that example, be quite thoughtful about, you know, I'm not sure I necessarily need the whole kitchen sink, right? I just need to find those drops of information that may lead me to someone. So I think that there are a lot of allies around privacy protection in government and other institutions who would also agree that just because we can get that data, it doesn't mean we need to.
What's the good part about sharenting, Leah?
So many good things. I believe that it can be a very, very meaningful way for families to stay in touch. And certainly part of the thought compass idea we talked about earlier in the hour is the importance of families just figuring out for themselves how to do it in a way that feels comfortable. So Dan from Nashua shared in his family the way they're communicating with family and friends who might be far away is not by social media. But I certainly think that for a family to make a thoughtful decision of, you know what, we've got friends all over the world, we have family all over the world, we can't send a gazillion text messages, the value of connection and of relationship building outweighs potential privacy harms. I think that's very valid. I also think that there is a really powerful way in which sharenting can lift up underrepresented groups of people and underrepresented issues. I've seen sharenting used really admirably by parents and caregivers who may have children with them who have disabilities or chronic illness as a way of really humanizing something that may seem abstract to people who are not living with that reality in their own homes. And so sharenting can be a way to forge really powerful social and political change. And I think that so much political will can be marshaled by sharing things that are personal. I also am not ruling out that there are ways in which sharenting can ultimately level the playing field, right? So if you have a school, let's say, that is using some sort of predictive analytics software to figure out this child should go in that classroom or this child should have this kind of career trajectory, if that product is as free from bias as it can be and the human decision makers using it have appropriate policies and procedures in place, there are ways in which getting digital data points about kids through sharenting or from the kids themselves can then help decision makers actually make choices that are freer from bias because they're getting relevant data points and using them in a thoughtful way.
Give us a specific example of what you're talking about, Leah, because I think some people may not be familiar with sort of the way data is collected, what kind of data, and these analytical tools and how they're used.
Sure. So I think an example would be if you have a school system that is using, and I'll use a very, very basic one. So I was using kind of the more kind of a fancier one just now. But let's say you have a school that has, you know, 30 kids in an elementary school class. They're not all going to read at the same level. So rather than the teacher just kind of, you know, before the first day of school, doing her best or his best or their best to figure out what the reading group should be, or having the kid read out loud a couple of times and then sorting them into reading groups. Well, you could have implicit bias creeping in. The child could be nervous that first day. If you're using an app, which I know, for instance, Concord Public Schools are, then the children are self-paced and they're able to read at their level and have individualized instruction at their level without the need for a human to come in and directly read with them and say, okay, you're in reading group A, you're in reading group B. So that's an example of an educational technology that's taking in data here, very limited data, just about reading ability, and using it to supply a meaningful benefit to kids, which is level appropriate reading instruction.
Wow, that's really interesting. Let's go back to our listeners, Leah. And Reeve is calling from Wolfboro. Hi, Reeve. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, I wanted to let you know that an awful lot of apps are allowing phones to start listening all the time, listening even when the phone is turned off. And I am now instituting an RFID bag at the door, just a phone bag. People drop their phones in, and and now everybody has privacy.
Wow. And Reeve, in terms of your own family, thoughts about sharenting?
In my own family, it is. I am not a parent, so I don't have to worry about that. But I do worry for children, and I worry for their privacy. So when people are visiting me, I want them to be safe. I also totally am wowed by the not smart home. I prefer to be the smartest thing in my home. And we're just not paying attention that TVs can observe who's there. They're observing everything around you, and everything is so. We have to be incredibly careful this way. So thank you for your work.
Well, Reeve, thank you very much. And it is kind of creepy to think that devices, it's one thing to put information into a device and send it to someone or a large number of people. It's another thing to think that that device is actually listening to you.
Or that it could be turned on at a random time that you don't know. So there's the always listening creepiness. And I agree completely with the caller's observation. And then there's the not knowing when it might spring to life, right, and start recording. So I agree completely that having the smartest thing in the home be a human is a great goal to strive for. In my house, it might be my dog. But.
How much do you think, Leah, parents, teachers, you know, coaches, other trusted adults realize the extent of the possible damage that could come from over-sharenting? You read in the book about the, quote, default setting of poorly understood and problematic adult behavior. So what's that default setting, Leah?
the tech companies build technologies that try to make us addicts to them, and they often succeed. I am not immune to this myself. There is something extremely addictive and powerful about every whoosh and click and zing. And so I think that those of us who are parents and teachers and other adults who did not grow up digital, so I'm almost sort of would put that at, you know, coming of age, you know, well before 2004 when Facebook became a big thing. We are learning about these technologies at the same time that our kids are. So unlike other areas of home life and education, where I'd like to think we adults have a leg up because we've learned our multiplication tables, we've learned how to drive, we've had our heart broken so we can talk, you know, a teen through a breakup, we're figuring out apps and smart devices and phones and sensors at the same time that our kids are. So we're in it with them, yet we have under the law and just practically from day to day this essentially unfettered discretion to decide what to do in our homes and with their information. So when I talk about a default setting of problematic behavior, and I include myself in this, right, because my cell phone's practically glued to me. And as the last caller just pointed out, fine, I may not be putting photos of my child on Instagram, but who knows what that app is picking up about who's around me, and my kids often are. And so I think that's part of the problem, is we're all coming of age together when it comes to privacy and digital technology. And we adults actually may be less familiar with the nuts and bolts of technology as our children are.
Oh, I would say the children are coming of age more quickly than we are.
Fair enough.
And it reminds me, sometimes you hear stories of immigrant families where the parents just takes longer to learn English when you come to this country when you're older, and the kids learn it right away, and the kids are actually at, it gives them a power advantage over their parents. This digital divide between adults and kids kind of sounds like the same thing.
I agree completely, and that's part of why I find the prevalence of sort of surveillance and tracking technologies that are marketed to parents and schools, sort of, you know where your child is, keep your child safe. There's certainly an appeal to that, and there are certainly circumstances where I would think an individual family or school might be justified in using that. But I also think that kids and certainly teens can often get their way around sort of digital fences we put up for them. So we really have a lot to learn from them rather than having them just essentially kind of school us.
Well, if they choose to teach us, that's another issue. Leah, we could have talked a lot longer. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you being here.
Had a wonderful time.
That's Leah Plunkett, professor at the UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law, faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. Her new book that we talked about is called Sharenthood, Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.